The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Back to Breaking Banks. We are coming to you from New York today. We have some great interviews for you today. We're going to be hearing about crowdfunding and a bunch of other stuff. So in the news today, PayPal founder Levchin raised $275, that's Max Levchin, one of the PayPal mafia, raised $275 million for his lending startup, Affirm, which is designed to let merchants advance credit to consumers at the point of sale. Should work, interestingly, with iBeacon technology. But the big news, yesterday we heard that US authorities, FinCEN, has thrown the book at Ripple. They reported in their press release for this, which came out actually on May 5th, technically Tuesday, they said they had assessed a $700,000 civil money penalty against Ripple and its wholly owned subsidiary XRP for violation of the Bank Secrecy Act by acting as a money services business and selling its virtual currency without registering with FinCEN and failing to implement AML. So that's the big news. If you're a fintech player, you do need to work with regulators. Don't think you're outside of the regulatory environment. You do need to court them. So this is important. So let's welcome back Ian Carr to the show. Ian, welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Hey, Brett. How are you?
You're a regular now, man.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty exciting.
Cool.
So I enjoy it.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you on. So you're, of course, you're our resident rumor mill guy. So, when I was younger, I used to listen to this show in Australia. It was a sports show. Uh-huh. And they used to talk, always talking about rumors in sports.
Oh, I used to love sport rumors.
Yeah, and it was always like, there's this. So I was in the lift the other day with this guy who sits next to this other guy who has a neighbor that lives across the road from the head of the football league. And he said... So it's not those rumors, right? It's a bit more substantiated than that. But you broke a story.
It's a little more substantiated.
Yeah, you broke a story a couple of days ago. Obviously, you're our Apple guy as well. But so you broke a story the other day about where Apple might go next. We know Canada's on the cards, but where would they go after that?
So it looks like Ireland's on the map as well. According to my sources, Apple's been talking to the Bank of Ireland. And other Irish media outlets have reported that they were talking to some banks, but they didn't really specify which ones. I was finally able to lock down which one, and one of them was Bank of Ireland. And so they're looking at, I think, the same timetable, maybe around, I think the Wall Street Journal said they're looking to add Canada in November. And I wouldn't expect any countries to be added before Canada. So maybe around the same timetable, but Ireland's definitely on the horizon for Apple when it comes to expanding Apple Pay. And so is the UK. I think some other outlets have reported that Apple's been talking to UK banks, but they're not really that happy with the deals that Apple's proposing, especially when it comes to data. And, I've been hearing similar things from other banks as well.
So just before we went on air, you told me that you are working on a story for that there's some banks who may not go the Apple Pay route or are not so keen to join on board, particularly in the UK, right?
Yeah, and I think, there's some hesitation is what I'm getting. And I don't really, and a lot of it has to do with the data, and I hope to get into that in my article. And where the data is going, who owns the data, the transaction data, and this is a big money-making thing, too, for the banks. The banks are essentially sitting on a gold mine when it comes to transaction data.
Right.
So they're not very keen to give it up. And Apple's and Tim Cook has been pretty open about, you know, Apple doesn't take any data and stuff like that. So I'm looking to get into the transaction data aspect on the, in the relationship with the banks and Apple.
It's pretty incredible, though. It's like, obviously, this is going the way of, you know, people paying with their phone. The banks don't have an alternative. You know, well, there's a few, like, you know, CommBank in Australia with Gaching and, you know, Barclays with Pingit and their, you know, wearables initiative. But, I mean, there's literally only a handful of banks that have any type of wallet capability, right? So,
yeah.
It surprises me that even in the face of it clearly going that way that...
But some people are saying, and, you know,
Okay. Any other Apple type news? And you know, you've been working on the loyalty stuff and the iBeacon stuff for a while. Any more rumors on that front?
No. Though I did. There are, you know, these ongoing rumors that Apple and China UnionPay have been talking. I mean, that's been going on since
last
summer.
Wow, that would be huge, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that was reported. I mean, last summer even, and MarketWatch has had two separate reports on Apple and UnionPay and the lack of progress in those talks. I recently wrote that Apple's been looking for an Apple Pay Asia team.
Right.
And so it looks like China's in the distant future as well for Apple Pay. And they have a lot of NFC terminals out there. So it makes sense that China's on the horizon as well.
So one of the fintech mafia who's been on the show previously was approached by Apple Pay in Asia. So I can confirm that is happening. I don't know if he said yes. I'll have to ask him. I won't mention his name. I won't call him out on the show because he's currently employed by quite a well-known organization in that part of the world. I can't be any more specific because it'll just give it away.
Yeah. But, no, I don't want you to give it away. But yeah, I mean, I've heard that Apple's extensively looking. I've been in touch with people that have been reached out to for the positions on the Apple Pay Asia team. And I think they're just looking for someone to head up the division. And they might have found someone. I haven't gotten any confirmation, but they might have found someone. I'm not very sure about that yet. So
Great.
Hopefully we'll have more info on that in the future.
Fantastic. So, Ian, for those that aren't familiar with your writings on this stuff, where can they find your blog?
FintechToday.net is where I'm writing, and please come and visit and send any feedback.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for checking in with us. We'll have you on again in a couple of weeks.
All right.
We have some more rumors for us. That was Ian Carr. So independent journalist now runs fintechtoday.net. So thanks, Ian.
Thanks.
So up now we're going to interview from Quartz. If you guys have been listening to the show regularly, we talk about Quartz. We spoke previously about a great article was up there on the Venmo line, and Quartz is a global business news site, of course, brought to you from the Atlantic, and a reporter on Quartz did a really interesting story on crowdfunding over the last week. Shelley Banjo. So Shelley, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I read this article on Once Idealistic, crowdfunding is now an unholy hybrid of retail investment and risk. So, you know, there was this period, of course, Kickstarter was one of these amazing stories of social and finance and, Web 2.0. And, of course, has been a very interesting experiment. But, you know, we hear stories of, crowdfunded projects that don't come to fruition and are being sued now and things like that. But we still are getting these record numbers behind some of these crowdfunding projects. And, of course, it aligns with what we talked about, financial inclusion as well for microfinance and other stuff that's happening around the world. So, you know, it does fill a niche. But give us a little bit of a background on the story and what drove you to write this on Quartz.
Sure. Yeah, I had just spoken with quite a few people who had either been burned by one thing or another, and it got us thinking, you know, has Kickstarter really evolved into a sense of finance? And the more we got into it, we realized that you know, it's not exactly finance. You're not exactly investing in Kickstarter. You're not exactly buying something from Kickstarter. You're not exactly donating something to Kickstarter. It's kind of this murky world where we're going into. And the more I got into it, the more I realized that this murky world is about to get even more murkier as we start evolving from just crowdfunding to really equity crowd investing.
You tell the story of this ZPM Espresso, which is sort of one of these examples of how the funds are used. Do you want to just, for those that haven't read the article, did you want to just give us a summary of that story?
Sure. We chose this business, ZPM Espresso, because how much it resonated with a bunch of Kickstarter backers, people who get really into something. You know, there were a couple of people, some former engineers, that decided, you know what, we can build a better commercial quality home espresso machine. And they thought, you know what, we have made all the components by hand. We're just going to assemble 50 and we're going to send them out and see if it works, see if there's really going to gain traction on here. Overnight, you know, the founders went to sleep. Overnight, they had raised thousands of dollars. Eventually, they got to $370,000 in a matter of days, and people were shelling out $250, $300 for this espresso machine. And this started back in 2011.
I would have put $300 on an espresso machine.
Yeah, people are very into coffee, and this really tapped into something, a need in the marketplace where people said, I want this, and I also want these people to succeed. And, you know, kind of, and a lot of the backers were engineers, they were investors who said, I want to help you, I want to give you advice, you know, I really want to be part of the process. You know, each year that went by, they kept giving updates, you know, we're going to push back our production schedule. We're going to push back our production schedule. And eventually, just this a few months ago in January of this year, they officially threw in the towel and said, you know, that's it. And during that time, they had incorporated as a company. They had raised additional funding from equity investors. They had started their own website where they were selling pre-orders that was not even related to Kickstarter. They were just saying, you know, buy this and we'll promise to ship it to you. You know, and they basically got so big that they couldn't handle it. They were just burning money, and eventually they had to close down.
Did you, were you able to speak to anyone from ZPM?
I did. I spoke to one of the founders who said, you know, they still are trying to sell this, you know, their intellectual property to some other company that could develop it. But it seems very kind of pie in the sky because, you know, who's going to want to buy a company that, you know, has all these liabilities to it, and how much intellectual property do they have? We don't really know.
Yeah, so it's interesting. You showed the figures on crowdfunding. It rose by 167% in 2014. Went from 6 billion in 2013 to 16.2 billion last year, and it's probably set to increase again this year, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's only going up from here because people. What's happening now is that people are realizing, okay, this is here to stay. And a lot of countries, including the U.S., U.K. is probably the furthest along on this. But the U.S., U.K., China, Germany, all of them passing, you know, some types of rules, regulations around these types of investments and campaigns to try to, acknowledge the fact that this is here to stay. People are into this. And, you know, if this is here to stay, we should probably be taking a look at it.
Are you familiar with the over-the-counter stock market, the OTC market?
Sure, like, you know, penny stocks?
I just wonder, actually, if at $16 billion, whether this is greater than the OTC market in the U.S.
Well, $16 billion is worldwide, but I don't know.
But a lot of that's got to be U.S.-based, right?
Yeah, a big part is U.S., but the U.K. is actually fairly robust and advanced on this on this field as well.
That's very, very interesting. You know, I don't know how many billions of dollars passed, but this is certainly, you know, Kickstarter has been a market maker for crowdfunding. It's pretty interesting. In terms of the retail aspect of this, you know, we've of course heard of Pebble Watch and Oculus got their start on Kickstarter, which you reference. What are some of the more interesting success stories that you've seen? Are there some that you'd like to sort of call out?
Sure. We spoke to this one company, Canary, that makes security systems. And what was interesting about Canary that was different from a lot of other folks is that the way they approached Kickstarter was that it was really for the capital they needed to create the to create the actual product, the home security device. What they then went out and raised money from traditional VCs for, you know, the parts to actually build a company, the overhead, the hires, that kind of thing, which I thought was it was sort of a different kind of business model that people don't take into consideration sometimes when they're starting these new campaigns on Kickstarter or Indiegogo or any of the number of websites out there.
So if you want to check out this article, it's on Quartz.com. Well, it's QZ.com is actually the website. It's called Once Idealistic, Crowdfunding is Now an Unholy Hybrid of Retail Investment and Risk. It's a great article. Also points out that there's a fair bit of risk in the UK. 60% of the investors who invested in crowdfunding, it was their first investment. And so this is why the financial watchdog in the UK said, the UK Financial Conduct Authority, it's very likely you'll lose all your money. So some great reporting there, thanks for coming on the show, Shelley, and keep us informed of your continuing research on this.
Great, thank you so much.
Thanks, Shelley, and of course, thanks, Ian. We'll have some more rumors from Ian, no doubt, very soon. If you're in San Jose next week at Finovate, come and say hello. If you haven't joined yet, check out the Breaking Banks discount code, BreakingBanks20. And a quick thank you, too, for Jumio, who sponsored a webinar with us together with Breaking Banks earlier in the week and is a regular sponsor of the show. All right, we'll be right back after this break, guys.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
It's been probably the best thing we've ever done, without a doubt.
In 2011, Duane Blomstrom and Maniga headed to the first Finovate in Europe.
We were a very small company back then, 6 people. We had decided that we were going to actually demo, which was a big step for a small company at that time.
After winning Best of Show, they grew to be a European market leader in personal financial management.
Pipeline essentially exploded as a result of this. It essentially put us on the map.
So why do they keep going back to Finovate?
It keeps us honest innovation-wise.
Register today for Finovate Spring 2015 in San Jose on May 12th and 13th and experience future fintech first.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charge statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
So, banks have a nice little exchange rate going on between themselves called the interbank rate, but another bigger exchange rate for you when you want to send money home or overseas. And they'll throw in some bank charges too, just for good measure. Not really fair, is it? But what if you could set your own exchange rate? That would be currency fair. CurrencyFair.com is a peer-to-peer marketplace that gets you closer to and sometimes beats the interbank exchange rate and bypasses those bank charges. You can't say fairer than that. CurrencyFair.com, the smarter way to send money home or abroad.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Movin' app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Movin.com. That's M-O-V-E-N.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. Now, before the break, we had a very interesting discussion with Shelley from Quartz on crowdfunding. But just before we get going with Andre, who's joining us from City, I don't know whether you saw the news. You know, it's the presidential races hotting up in the U.S. here, where we broadcast Breaking Banks from in New York. The presidential races, of course, across the U.S. But really, a really funny thing, I saw Carly Farina, who, has announced her running for president. Someone's got her domain, carlyfarina.org, and if you check it out, it's quite funny. They've totally trolled her in terms of her presidential campaign. The website, I'm just bringing it up so I can read it out to you guys. It says, Carly Farina failed to register this domain, so I'm using it to tell you how many people she laid off at Hewlett Packard. It was this many, and it has smiley faces. Well, of course, they're frowny. You know, what do you call that? Sad faces. And it goes down the page, down the page. Anyway, so Andre, I hope you've registered your domain name.
Brett, hi, and thanks for having me. No, I haven't. I'll be back in just half a second. I have to go register my name.
Very good. So for those of you who are familiar with City's recent moves, you probably know Andre. So right now, it's great for us to welcome Andre Wahlberg-Stopp, and he's the global head of emerging platforms and services at City.
I am heavily involved in mobile.
So you're also involved here in the U.S. with the Consumer Bankers Association, and you represent Citi on that. And, of course, prior to being emerging platforms, you did mobile and tablet anyway, right? So
I did mobile and tablet before this, yes. This is more about emerging capabilities and about figuring out where we go on the platform side from a business perspective.
So you must know Rich Clow.
He's a good friend and colleague, yes.
Yeah, Rich has been on the show before, and he has been on the show, hasn't he, Rachel? I'm sure he's been on the show. Yeah, he has, yeah. But it's been some time, hasn't it? So Citi has had a long history of talking about the fact that it wants to be a global fintech bank and very strongly committed to this API approach for a bank to connect. And the first example of that API approach, of course, was Citi's integration or cooperation with the Google Wallet. But tell me a little bit about how that strategy has matured over the last couple of years, Andre, in terms of Citi's commitment to be this fintech bank for startups and other partners globally.
Yes, it's something that became apparent over time, and I think it's very close to some things that are of great interest to you in the way of themes about how banks need to become more nimble, more agile, more open, how they need to open their arms to innovation that happens outside of their walls, and how they just have to become faster at producing great customer experiences. I know these are things you've thought about and that you write about a lot, and we think it's very true. I think there's a risk of being left behind as new entrants in the marketplace reinvent the customer experience and take away slices of the relationship with your customers. So best way to do that is to, we think, decouple your customer front ends so that you can iterate them very quickly and just have a better, much more modular way of connecting to all of the complexity behind your walls so that you can work on the front ends without having to drag along all the less modern systems behind you.
So is decoupling the new unbundling? We hear a lot about unbundling these days, don't we?
Yeah, you have to decouple in order to unbundle. decoupling, you know, basically, if you take the back off of an old radio set, you will see a lot of wires going point to point from one component to the other, right? And that is pretty much the way a big bang works today. If you look behind even the more modern mobile apps or the more remarkable website experiences, there's a lot of point-to-point soldering going on behind the scenes. And that takes a lot of time. It's confusing. You have to find people. You have to train people in this sort of esoteric knowledge, and only they can code. And then if you're doing different channels, you probably have to do the same work over and over again, etc. The solution is to replace all that complexity, the spaghetti connections, with clean, well-documented, easy-to-use connectors, like APIs, that are as simple to snap together as Lego bricks.
Where does this start in Citi, this drive to decouple? I mean, is this from the board down? Is this an initiative to the side? How is this approached within Citi from an organizational perspective?
I would say it's one of those ideas for which the time is clearly right, because you start to see different teams, different people starting to think about it and to talk about it more or less simultaneously. For the last few years, Citi, I'm sure other big banks, have set up these layers of middleware that took care of some of the connections. I think it was designed more for expediency probably in the beginning and less for modularity and for an open bank approach. This is just a natural evolution of those early steps, but it goes all the way up to the top, to the absolute top of the organization. Everybody is totally on board with the need for this big transformation, which is going to be a big one, right? There are hundreds of services and data sets that you need to turn into these modular connectors. The rewards potentially, though, are just huge.
Now, we've seen recently the Apple Watch announcement. You guys have made a big play in this respect. Rich was actually giving me a hard time on Twitter saying that because you guys announced your Apple Watch app before we did. So he was saying, finally, Citi beat moving to something. But tell us a little bit about your Apple Watch approach.
So the Apple Watch is a, I would say, a dual-purpose project. First, of course, we want it to be out there at the birth of one of these new device classes from Apple. I think it's the first time a bank, any bank, has been there from day zero when one of these devices hits the market. So that in and of itself, and being there for our early adopter clients, etc., that was definitely a goal. And of course, you can forecast that an event like that is going to have very high visibility. And so, you know, a little bit of it will attach if you manage to be there on day one. But the bigger and ultimately, frankly, much more important goal was to change the way we work. And let's not be naive. You know, it's not that because we did this in under 120 days from the first blank whiteboard to live in production in the App Store, it's not because we did it in 120 days that we have changed the way we work. It's more a sort of rallying cry, an example that, hey, you see, we can do this sort of stuff if we put our minds to it. So changing the way we work is the bigger goal here. And when you're embarking on a big transformation, and when that transformation has as many cultural components to it as technical components, it's really important to create these moments of success that you can point to for the whole organization.
The quick
to see
wins.
That this is exactly a big win, something that you can point to and say, This is the sort of stuff we can do.
So I want to talk about this decoupling approach, but specifically the Apple Watch. When Jony Ive was when there was a profile piece done on Jony Ive in the New Yorker recently, and it said that when he saw Google Glass, he said that's not the right place for a notification. The right place is on your wrist. And, you know, Apple has put this restriction on the app. The Apple app guidelines are no more than 10 seconds in the app. So the app is definitely designed for these. We've heard this new term emerge, glanceable insights, and sort of a very different type of interaction from the smartphone. Google Glass, likewise, the way these augmented reality overlay technologies seem to be evolving is it's more about these notifications that are contextualized. So you've got this new layer emerging that's not apps on a smartphone, it's notifications on these new wearable devices. How does that work from an architecture perspective in terms of messaging and how you guys think about articulating that, from a product and service perspective?
First of all, I think everyone needs to be clear that doing something on wearables is definitely not about doing mobile only smaller or sort of packing.
Right, so it's not putting a smartphone app on a wearable. That's not the game.
Exactly, just as everyone has since figured out that doing mobile is not about packing online into a smartphone. So that's point number one. Point number two is...
That's how we started with banking, right? We said, let's put a plastic card in a mobile wallet and let's stick internet banking on a smaller screen. So we're evolving past that, right?
Well, yes. And you could pull on that string and go even further back, right? The first online experiences were basically at a
bank statement.
ATM, right?
Or ATM and bank,
And then the ATM of the ledger and the ledger paper segment. So it is all a continuum, but there are points of discontinuity. And when you go from smartphone to smartwatch, there is clearly a break in the experience that you have to design for. So We have this sort of house-grown rule about the three I's, which is immediacy, intimacy, and importance. And to your question about the glance and the push notifications, you can actually reuse your existing architectures if you have the right pieces to provide the immediacy, as in a push notification every time your credit card is used somewhere, whether it's online or in a store, your watch will wake up and ping you and say, hey, something happened on your credit card. And then the intimacy comes from being able to access your accounts on the watch, see your balances, last five transactions for each account, without, and this is critical, without having to type in a PIN or a password or anything.
Right.
And the reason we were able to do that on the watch, it looks really simple, but in fact, it's only because we had launched, actually a year ago, in May 2014, we launched it nationwide, a feature. It's patented, actually. The patent was issued just this week. It's called City Mobile Snapshot, and it's the first feature from a major U.S. bank that lets you check your balances on mobile and latest transactions without having to type in a password or a PIN. So having that as a building block, it was, I would say, easy, not trivial, but easy to reproduce that sort of experience on the watch in a way that makes for immediacy, intimacy, and importance.
That's I think that intimacy is interesting. Now, you mentioned here that they can do certain interactions or they get certain information that doesn't require them to log in. And this seems to be a little bit of a strategy here where we're now starting to understand that certain information shouldn't necessarily require, it's a degradation in user experience if you've got to log in every time.
Oh, absolutely.
How are users responding to seeing information like their balance without logging in or, transaction alerts without logging in?
They're responding really, really well. So obviously the trick is you have to make sure that you're doing it in a way that's safe and that you're not exposing any information that would create a risk for the user, any personally identifiable.
So how do you reinforce that it's safe with users? Is that part of the onboarding process to these new features or?
Well, you describe it when they're signing up and so on and so forth. But I think increasingly as the profile of users of smartphones becomes broader and broader and encompasses all sorts of demographics, it's going to be increasingly hard to satisfy all components of that demographic at once. So you will have people who will think, oh, this doesn't feel right for me, etc. But you will have many, many others who do adopt it. And what we're seeing is for those who are using this snapshot feature, they're actually accessing their accounts three times more often than those who don't, which is not a surprise. I mean, think about, let's say, Facebook. If you had to enter a password every time to see what your friends are up to, or on Amazon, if you had to enter your password every time just to get personalized offers, yeah, evidently like, the experience would be, you know.
Yeah. Or if banking worked like, oh, sorry, if Amazon worked like banking, then you could look at all the books you'd bought, but you could only buy a book when you went back to the bookstore.
Well, something like that, right? And instead, obviously, what you know, the best practice is you push the need for authentication as far back as you can in the experience so that you only invoke the password at the last possible minute when you really, really need it, not up front when you don't.
So the key is this, you do want to protect users from someone who steals their phone or their device so that they can't get they can't send money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the reality is, I think conceptually, if someone sees your balance, okay, maybe that's a negative, but at the same time, you know, they can't do any real damage, right? But if they can send money, then, you know, that's obviously a pretty big issue.
That's exactly right. And so what you do is you protect transactions behind a password or Touch ID or some additional form of authentication, and you only leave the read-only information out front.
Now, that makes sense. So, Andre, let's have a quick break, and then when we get back from the break, we'll talk about what Citi's plans are for the next couple of years. So you're listening to Breaking Banks. We have Andre Wahlberg-Stock on from Citi. We'll be right back after this short word from our sponsors.
Time. There's never enough. You just don't have the time to search out all the latest banking innovations from around the world. But the good news is, we've already done it for you at Banking Reports. 700 hours of research goes into each edition of our Global Banking Innovation Monitor. Be smarter and get one step ahead. Get Banking Reports sent quarterly to your inbox. To subscribe, follow us on Twitter at banking_reports.
Banks. Who needs them? Okay, we all do. But if you're sending money overseas, you could do without the rip-off exchange rates and bonkers bank charges. That's where Currency Fair comes in. CurrencyFair.com lets you exchange currency direct and transfer funds to bank accounts worldwide. So you get a fair exchange rate and get away from paying those crazy bank charges. How good does that sound? I know, really good. Find out more at CurrencyFair.com, the smarter way to send money home or abroad.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
So, banks have a nice little exchange rate going on between themselves, but another, bigger exchange rate for you when you want to send money home or overseas. And they'll throw in some bank charges too, just for good measure. Not really fair, is it? But what if you could set your own exchange rate? That would be Currency Fair. CurrencyFair.com is a unique peer-to-peer marketplace that means you get a better rate and get to bypass those bank charges. You can't say fairer than that. CurrencyFair.com, the smarter way to send money home or abroad.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. If you're following the discussion online and you'd like to participate, the hashtag is #BreakingBanks. Hashtag Breaking Banks. You can call in. You can also ping me. My Twitter ID is Brett King. Feel free to join the conversation. Last week's show, when we were in Vegas, we had Sean Park debating one of the participants in the show via Twitter. It was great, and we had David Horton from Dubai and Dave Birch from the UK. So it really is a global show now. 72 countries Breaking Banks goes out to. So no pressure, Andre. You don't feel nervous, right, going out to 72 countries and a million listeners?
It's pretty natural. We're a multinational too, you know.
True. So let me talk about this. Before the break, we were talking about a city's ethos in sort of the digital space and the move towards this decoupling of things. But I want to talk specifically about the sort of organizations you're hoping to attract to work with City. And we talked about the Google Wallet, but who else are you designing this API and new fintech ecosystem for?
Well, first of all, to be honest, we're designing it for ourselves so that we can iterate our front ends, our digital customer channels much more quickly at digital speed as we need to. But at the same time, we are truly going towards an open banking model, however you define that. But to give you a very concrete example, just last week, we did the Europe, Middle East, and Africa edition of our City Mobile Challenge. I don't think we can call it a hackathon, but it's a sort of open bank contest. And in this edition, it's the third. We began in Latin America last year, then a very successful edition in the US. And then just now, it was Nairobi, Jerusalem, Warsaw, and London, all of it last week. So it was a very tough week. But there were 745 different teams from 101 countries. And the subtext, the caption to that is, we realize we cannot come up with all the best ideas ourselves, and we really need others to come in and, in a very friendly way, give us a couple of kicks where they are needed and just propel us to a place where we're bringing in new ideas from the outside and maybe bridging that divide between fintech and traditional banks that you're so
fond of having on the show.
Yes, exactly.
So tell me about your plans for the next couple of years. I mean, what you obviously talked about the decoupling and the notifications and the different wearable strategies and things like that. But in terms of emerging platforms and the global approach and play, which of the markets do you find really interesting, Andre?
So all the markets in which we're present with consumer banking, which is 24 markets around the world right now, obviously it pales in comparison to the 160 markets in which we're present with our corporate banking services. But even our consumer markets, I think, there is so much cross-pollination we are going to be able to do once we're on common platforms and once we have moved to this API transformation. It is going to be something that takes a little while. You can't just snap your fingers and get that done overnight. But at the end of that journey, we should be able to plug in services, great experiences from third-party companies, big or small, really easily. And to be honest, if they don't deliver on the ROI or on the intent, or if customers don't like it, we should be able to rip it out just as easily and just as quickly. Which will be a huge difference with the way things have happened in the past, where it actually takes a lot of work and a fair amount of time to integrate those things. And then it also takes a fair amount of time to pull them out if you no longer want them. So that agility, I think, is the main thing.
Sounds very much like the whole agile push, right?
It is. It is. But how else do you remain relevant and even win in the digital space? You certainly are not going to do that if you stick to your old quarterly data center release schedule, right? Now, you asked about market spread. And I would say that I don't think the geographies are going to be so important. I prefer to think about it in terms of, just to put an acronym on it, the Internet of Things, and where we go, where we are present, not so much geographically or not just geographically, but how we can be present in all the right places and all the right times where it's useful to our clients. And that may mean not always making them to come to a city-branded channel to look at their accounts or to manage their finances. It might be about going out and being able to meet them on whatever digital property that they're spending their time on. It can also be about having money basically disappear from view and become embedded in an Internet of Things where you just walk around in this sort of shrouded in this cloak of value, as we call it, where you don't need to be pulling out a wallet or plastic or even tapping anything, where it's just all connected all the time. And
we've already seen tendencies towards that. I mean, we've got the blockchain and Bitcoin, but
that's right.
Yeah, but even just Uber with its payments experience, the payment essentially disappeared out of the taxi driving experience,
and I think that's out of view. And why shouldn't it? Right? I mean, why should it be the salient point of the experience? It no longer has to.
Yeah, it's what happens before and what happens after. So very interesting. And what about your partnerships with Apple and Facebook and stuff like that? Can you talk about those? I mean, you're involved in the Google Wallet, but what about with Apple Pay?
So Apple Pay, obviously, Citi was one of the first six original issuers, and it was great. It was a privilege, I would say, to be there at the birth of that. We're also partnering, for instance, with IBM on, in fact, they helped us.
With Watson?
They helped us with the Apple Watch design and some of the development of that app. And we're also working with them on the platform side for this API transformation, etc. So I think it's interesting that two very large companies. One is going to be 100 years old. Citi has just turned 200 years old. It can still be innovating together and doing interesting, cool stuff that sometimes is out there faster than the stuff from the fintech world.
Yeah, sometimes. I like when you say sometimes. Because we're pretty fast in the fintech world here, Andre.
Right, but you know what? Let me just tell you a quick story about our iPad app back in 2011. Sure. So we managed to be the first major U.S. bank out with an iPad app. This was months after the iPad had become available, and we actually beat three companies by 3, 9, and 18 months, respectively, and that was Facebook, LinkedIn, and Yahoo Mail. I think the fact that and
you guys and with respect, you guys were pretty quick on the Apple Watch. So kudos there. There's obviously a strong commitment to this this approach. So, listen, Andre, what I'd like to do is invite Brett Myers onto the show at this point. Brett was on the show a few weeks back with our Irish show, our St. Patrick's Day. It was just like 2 days after St. Patrick's Day or a day after St. Patrick's Day. We did a Irish-themed show, and Brett was on that. But he had some exciting news. So given that he's an alumni of the show, we thought we'd welcome him back. Brett Myers, he's the co-founder and CEO of Currency Fair. Welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Thanks very much, Brett. Good to be here.
So tell us about your big news. I saw it on TechCrunch. You guys just announced a raise, huh?
We did. Yeah, we announced a 10 million euro fundraising. So that's great. Really lets us move forward in a number of areas. So quite excited about that.
Can you talk about who's involved in the syndicate that backed that?
Yeah, it was led by Octopus Investments out of the UK in London, and also participating were Frontline Ventures, which is an Irish VC which have been involved with this for well over a year now, as well as a number of smaller investors, some angel investors and staff and so on.
Is Octopus Investments any relation to the Octopus in Hong Kong? Doesn't look like it.
No, I don't think so.
And so, you know, what are you going to do with your $10 million in funding? Well, let's start with, for those that didn't hear your interview last time, what is Currency Fair?
Yeah, essentially, we set up Currency Fair. I'm an expat, as you can probably tell from my accent, that I'm, even though I live in Ireland, I'm Australian. So we're really solving the pain point.
A reformed Aussie.
Exactly.
Like myself.
Yeah, exactly. I guess the pain point, and you probably know about it as well, for a lot of expats, and it also translates to small businesses as well, is how difficult and expensive it is to send money internationally, just from bank account to bank account.
Yep. So in fact, you know, I mean, my story behind that is it got so difficult and painful for me. That I just no longer do it. You know, I had a situation where I had an account with ANZ and I would transfer money from Hong Kong and they changed the KYC rules without telling us, of course, where I couldn't send it from my – I was in Dubai at the time. I couldn't no longer send money from my Dubai account because I didn't have a residential address in Australia. Right. So they didn't tell us, of course, that these rules had changed. They just flagged it as a fraudulent inbound wire. Right. And after that, I couldn't do anything with that account because once it had been flagged as receiving a suspicious transaction from overseas, there's no way I could fix that. So it became, you know, I just couldn't operate the account anymore for what I needed. I couldn't send money back to Australia. So now I have an Aussie dollar account in Hong Kong. That's how I had to deal with it. It's just ludicrous.
Yeah. So there's all those ridiculous, you know, hassles you have to go through. And then on top of that, when you do actually are able to send the money, you get a big fee in the exchange rate, which a lot of people don't even notice, but it can be 3%, even 5%. I think the Aussie banks are running at about 5% at the moment on their FX charges. So it's insane. So what I did was I thought about what I did personally, which was if I needed Aussie dollars and I was over here in Europe, I figured out a way to contact friends of mine. So I had a friend who actually lives in London, or did at the time, but I knew she had Aussie dollars at home. So I'd ask her to send me some Aussie dollars through the local system in Australia into my Aussie account. Meanwhile, I'd send her some sterling out of my sterling account. So we'd both send free local transfers, but effectively we'd both exchange money. So we'd just work out the relevant amounts.
So this was the start of the business model.
Exactly. That was the idea that seeded it. So then you start to think, well, hang on. Phoning around to find a friend's a bit of a hassle. What if there was an online platform that enabled you to do this, but was safe, you know, so that you could feel free to make that kind of exchange, but with people that you didn't know? And that's really the idea behind Currency Fair. So it works as a marketplace that enables people to sort of match off flows in opposite directions. And we're processing well over 6 million euros a day going through the site at the moment. So it's really taking off.
This is big business, you know, transfer-wise, recently raised another $58 million led by Andreessen Horowitz. You've got World Remit, TransferGo, Azimo. Who was the one we talked about the other week? Can you remember that one, Rachel? Rachel's nodding her head in a bad way. She doesn't remember. Abra. You know, the Bitcoin-based transfer. This is a big problem, moving money cross borders. I mean, this is one of the key issues that the blockchain was supposed to solve, make it frictionless cross-border transactions. But as soon as you've got bank accounts involved, you're going to need to have a formal transfer system. So let's get back to the other question. What are you going to do with the $10 million?
Well, there's a few things. I mean, mainly it's for two main purposes. I guess we need more people. We're running at about 65 staff at the moment, I think. But with all the projects we have lined up and the things we want to work on, it's crazy to have so few staff in that sense. So we need to hire. So that's one thing.
And you've also you've got staff in Australia as well, right?
We do. Yeah, I think we've 9 people down in Australia at the moment. And that's good because with the main office in Dublin, it gives us 24-hour coverage, which, you know, lets us answer the phones 24 hours a day and keep things running. So that's handy. But I guess the second purpose for the cash is really to start spending a bit more on the marketing side. We've grown really strongly with not a huge amount of marketing spend to date. You know, we've stepped it up in the last year or so, but you know, you can't just create a, you know, a platform like this, if you like, and expect everyone to suddenly hear about it. Word of mouth is great, but you need to, I think, supplement that with some paid marketing. So that's really the second.
So let me bring Andre back into the conversation here, because I'd be interested in, obviously, there's a big competitor emerging, potentially, or a partner, depending how you think about it, which is Facebook. Facebook has announced their payments, global payments initiative recently. And the word on the street is that they're running around all around the world right now trying to get remittance licenses and payments licenses to enable this. They do have a ready-made market of 1.6 billion people. It sort of makes sense. Do you want to start, Brett, with that? What do you think of Facebook's efforts in this space in terms of global remittance?
Yeah, I think it makes sense in the small payments area. So, whereas Currency Fair looks at really expat and SME invoice type payments, which are really, tend to be around 2,000 euros and up. I don't really see Facebook being the medium to pay an invoice for a business or to send money between your bank accounts. But certainly, if you want to pay your mate who's moved to Australia and you owe him 50 quid, that certainly works. So I think it's the small payment space. I don't think they're necessarily going to be super cheap either, because they will be, using the that fact that they have that inbuilt network.
Sure. Andre, what are your thoughts?
I think it makes sense for them to try to do this. It sounds like a good way to monetize the audience and the community that they've built. I would say, just looking at it from the experience of a large international bank, that there's probably going to be some interest that attaches to that from regulators everywhere, anti-money laundering authorities, etc., because it's not trivial. And I think if it becomes successful, it will probably attract that sort of interest.
Great. So we're going to be that's fantastic. So guys, thanks for joining us on the show today. It's always good to have sort of a global perspective. So if you want to check out Currency Fair, where can they find out about that, Brett?
Literally just straight online, currencyfair.com.
Great. And where are you going to be talking next, Andre, where people can hear more about the city's vision?
I'm at Apps World in San Francisco next week, and at the American Banker Digital Summit in Austin in June.
Fantastic. Great. Well, we might see you at one of those. So that was Andre Wahlberg-Stock from Citi and Brett Myers from Currency Fair. If you guys are regular listeners to the show, tune in next week. Next week, we've got Mark Hochstein from America Banker, who's going to join us next week. So thanks for being on the show again. You're listening to Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King. If you want to check out some of our previous episodes, go to breakingbanks.com. Thanks for joining us again this week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.